For the sixth year in a row, the United States is the largest oil producer in the world. As of March 2024, it's producing an average of 12.93 million barrels of oil per day, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and it periodically pops above that average for stretches of time, like in December of last year, when it managed to average just over 13.3 million barrels per day. That is an absolutely astonishing volume of oil. For context, while Saudi Arabia remains the holder of the world's most substantial spare oil capacity and was the largest oil exporter in 2023, they set aside plans to increase output to 12 million barrels a day back in January, which leaves them about a million barrels a day shy of the expansion target they set in 2020. And again, that was a 12 million target compared to the 12.93 million barrels of oil per day the U.S. is producing on average already. In 2023, the U.S. produced about 28% more oil than Russia and about 33% more than Saudi Arabia on average. The U.S. is becoming a huge player in oil exports too, but it really shines if you look not just at crude oil, but also natural gas liquids and refined petroleum products. In aggregate, in 2023, the United States exported nearly the same volume of these products that both Saudi Arabia and Russia produced, not exported, which is pretty wild. As is the fact that in December of 2023, the U.S. exported about 400 billion more cubic feet of natural gas than it imported. And it imports a lot, and it only started exporting natural gas a few years ago. So that is a figure for an industry that did not even exist until 2016, and it didn't really start to grow until the 2020s. The U.S. has not always been this kind of force in the global oil market. It's long been a consumer of huge quantities of the stuff. But while it produced a decent amount until the late 90s, competing with Russia and trailing Saudi Arabia, though not by much, U.S. production levels dropped substantially beginning in the early 90s, the U.S. becoming a huge importer of fossil fuels, its production levels dipping down to something closer to those of Iran by the mid-2000s. When 9/11 happened in 2001, one of the big concerns was that the U.S.'s fundamental reliance on Middle Eastern oil would complicate its military options and potentially hamstring its economy. That all changed, though, with what became known as the Shale Revolution, when the widespread investment in and deployment of hydraulic fracturing or fracking technologies, combined with developments that allowed for horizontal drilling, opened up huge swaths of new oil-rich territories in the U.S. and Canada in particular, making what were previously usable but incredibly expensive to exploit fossil fuel resources a lot less expensive and easier to tap. And southern U.S. states in particular saw a wave of new and expanded drilling, leading to a surge in the U.S.'s production output, and ultimately allowing the U.S. to become the top producer in the world beginning in 2018. The degree to which this has changed things geopolitically cannot be overstated, in the U.S. and globally to a certain degree. Stateside, petroleum prices became less tethered to the whims and political motivations of mostly Middle Eastern nations and Russia, which, working together via the OPEC Plus oil cartel, were long able to threaten and coerce the U.S. government and its allies in various ways. That remained the case for a while, even after this shale oil boom, as production and export figures were not optimally aligned. But as this new reality has set in, the U.S. government has been more strategic in how it has stockpiled fossil fuel resources and how it's been willing to use those stockpiles to manage price fluctuations for itself and its allies when warranted. This has also been important for manufacturing, shipping, and other energy-hungry aspects of the U.S. economy, and it has stoked booms in all sorts of consumer-facing industries alongside the deployment of power-hungry infrastructure like new power plants and things like data centers. Globally, this increased production has allowed the U.S. to become a player in energy diplomacy, exporting fuel to allies that needed it because of disasters or foreign meddling, and recently, the U.S. has taken this up a notch by bolstering Europe's energy supplies in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, an invasion that led to sanctions from the European Union against Russia, those sanctions arriving more slowly than they might have otherwise arrived because of concerns that Russia's stranglehold on much of the bloc's energy resources might turn into a chokehold, hobbling their economies, military preparedness, and civilian support for the sanctions, because people would be paying extreme prices for ever-shrinking volumes of energy from Russia. In the decades leading up to that invasion, many European nations, especially Germany, but a lot of others as well, completely recalibrated their economies so they could profit from Russian fuel. So the fear that those fuel supplies would dry up if they made the wrong move, supported Ukraine too ardently, pissing off Russia, was a significant concern, and it shaped a lot of what happened in those early days of the invasion. The U.S. started exporting liquefied natural gas to the bloc, though, which is a gas that's turned into a liquid using incredibly low temperatures, which shrinks it so that it's easier and cheaper to ship. And these shipments arrived first in drips and drabs because the infrastructure on the receiving end to convert that chilly liquid back into room temperature full volume gas needed to be installed. But once that infrastructure was in place, LNG, liquefied natural gas, began to arrive from the U.S. in huge volumes, a whole new energy economy popping up essentially overnight relative to how these things typically go anyway. And that enabled more and sterner sanctions from the EU of a kind that may not have been feasible, lacking that energy resource backstop from their ally. What I'd like to talk about today is another even more recent development within the U.S. oil industry and what it might mean for the future of that industry. You're listening to Let's Know Things. I'm Colin Wright. Learn more about Let's Know Things, subscribe to receive free email updates, and or become a supporter to receive monthly bonus episodes at letsknowthings.com. In 2023 alone, the businesses that make up the U.S. energy sector spent about $250 billion scooping up clients, suppliers, and rivals. A poll of energy executives in December of the same year suggested we could see another $50 billion or so invested in more acquisitions and mergers over the next 2 years. And in 2024 so far, as of mid-March, we've already seen APA by Callon, Chesapeake by Southwestern, Talos by Quarter North, and Sunoco acquire NuStar. These deals all close at the tail end of Q1 or in Q2 of 2024, and they were worth around $4.5, $7.4, $1.29, and $7.3 billion respectively, so nearly $20.5 billion worth of big oil industry deals already, and the year is just getting started. So that $50 billion figure is starting to look prescient. The majority of next step deals are expected to center around the Permian Basin, which is located in western Texas, with a little bit of overflow across the border into New Mexico. This basin is the highest producing oil field in the United States, generating nearly 6 million barrels of oil and around 25 billion cubic feet of natural gas each day, as of early 2024. And this is a region of intense investment and growth. Oil fields around the country are shutting down, and that increase in gas and oil production that we're seeing is mostly the consequence of more effective technologies and upgrades in the hardware and software being used by the industry. So better exploration, better tools to get to the best pockets of resources, better capturing technologies, and means of shuttling what they pump from place to place, it is a full stack of better tech and systems, and that is allowing the industry to consolidate its sprawl into fewer areas, many of them in the Permian Basin. And that's thought to be part of why we are seeing so much consolidation at the moment. more investment in fewer wells and fields in a smaller portion of the country is leading to more output, and that means the bigger companies with more R&D capacity and higher-end assets will tend to have a bigger advantage than their more dispersed, smaller rivals. It's anticipated, though, that a collection of variables, including that consolidation, will actually slow the growth of the U.S.'s fossil fuel-based energy industry, at least for the next couple of years. Less activity from fewer business entities and fewer investments that will lead directly to higher output is expected to nudge that 12.93 million barrels a day up by maybe 120 or 170,000 barrels per day, rather than the previously projected 1 million barrel a day increase. That is the EIA projection, at least. Some other analysts have higher expectations, in some cases double or quadruple that range. But the general consensus is that more of the oil wealth in this region being owned by larger entities that are aiming for consolidation, not growth in the sense of exploring and exploiting a bajillion new wells, will likely lead to a period of more tempered industry-wide growth and probably a period in which these now bigger companies will be focusing on getting all their ducks in a row, reducing redundancies and inefficiencies within their new combined portfolio of assets, and possibly eyeballing other acquisition targets as well. So that'll mean more investment in efficiencies, less investment in upping those already sky-high production numbers. All of this is happening within the context of efforts globally to reduce humanity's reliance on and use of fossil fuels. And that has led to some strange combinations of policies and political messaging, and no shortage of claims of hypocrisy from all sides of the conversation. Case in point, even as U.S. President Biden has celebrated U.S. energy independence and the associated security enabled and supported by this expansion of fossil fuel production and processing, he has also flogged and signed all sorts of laws and regulations meant to reduce oil use and to increase the deployment of solar, wind, and other clean energy sources. He has also pushed hard for government investment in clean energy and related infrastructure, including things like electric vehicles and upgrades for homes. And he is not alone in this. Other wealthy nations in particular have been pushing hard to emphasize and enable this transition, as all the data we have indicates the faster we shift away from burning fossil fuels and engaging in other emitting activities, the less destructive the impacts of human-amplified climate change will be, and the less expensive it will ultimately be to adapt to those new realities and to stop making them worse, to fully transition to a net zero and then eventually a practically non-emittive future. This seemingly bipolar stance can be disorienting, especially for those it directly impacts, though. And consequently, rather than making everyone happy, as both sides of the climate change, renewables, fossil fuels conversation are getting a fair bit of what they want due to these seemingly opposing investments, instead of making them happy, it is mostly just pissing everyone off, as environmentalists, climate change activists, and everyday people who are concerned about the impacts of the changing climate that they are seeing in the world around them more and more each year are irritated that the segue to a non-emittive energy future is not happening faster. While oil, gas, and coal companies, and those who have interests in the perpetuation and flourishing of such companies, are peeved that they are being elbowed out, despite having arguably gotten the country to where it is today, providing the U.S. economy with a substantial chunk of its overall income and wealth, energy exports of gas and oil are sky high, and despite, in a very real way, enabling modern everyday life, even for those people who want them and their products to disappear as quickly as possible. That perception of hypocrisy is difficult to sidestep then, because while yes, there has been a lot of new clean infrastructure deployed, many EV and similar companies have been invested in and otherwise supported, and on the other side, there have been all those big expansions of oil and gas infrastructure and an increase in the market for those sorts of products. Despite that, these two narratives are also in diametric opposition to each other, at least in the long term, and slow walking a transition away from fossil fuels makes climate change worse, its impacts more devastating and longer lasting, the worst stuff arriving faster, too, while the shift toward cleaner energy is stealing market share from those emissive energy companies. And this movement toward renewables puts a cap on fossil fuel companies' very existence as well. Some policies suggesting that these companies cannot exist, or at least not exist at any real scale, doing the type of business they've always done past a certain government-mandated date. And both of these perspectives are arguably true at the same time. So those victories both sides are accumulating are often lost in the sea of concomitant victories for the perceptually opposing side, which means they feel a whole lot like losses, and in some very real and practical ways, they are. It is worth noting, too, that both sides actually do have pretty good arguments in isolation, and especially if you ignore the best arguments of the other side. Lacking the dominant fossil fuel-based energy sources of today, the U.S. military would not be able to operate. It simply would not be able to function, which would have all sorts of probably quite negative, at least for the U.S. and its allies, knock-on effects until and unless all of those vehicles and missiles and other bits of hardware could be replaced with cleaner versions of the same. Lacking a full-scale replacement of every fuel-chugging car and bus and train and jet and other piece of transportation infrastructure, the U.S. economy would come to a halt overnight, and that would wreak untold havoc in country and around the world. There's a chance that certain plastic goods would disappear too, and a gobsmackingly large portion of all things created in the modern world are made of some kind of plastic, which is a petroleum product. And the well-being of that industry is in some ways correlated with the well-being of the rest of the industry's efforts. Because of the state of things right now too, because of what infrastructure we have installed and do not have installed, shifting away from petroleum products, from fossil fuels immediately, would also leave us with insufficient energy. Without the electricity, without the heating, without things like that, basic fundamentals to maintain a modern, healthy lifestyle. That said, if we do not shift away from the use of these fuels and materials as soon as possible, we may lose the ability to counter some of the worst aspects of climate change, including many that are deadly, like overpowered and more consistent, more regular storms and heat waves, alongside impacts that will take out ecosystems and the creatures living in those ecosystems permanently. And once those are gone, they are gone. Military conflicts and economy collapses may seem quaint compared to the cost and loss of lives and treasure associated with forthcoming, more common climate change-triggered disasters and norm shifts. There is some indication that some of the big oil companies are making tweaks to how they do things in order to reduce the distance between their economic and, in some ways, existential priorities and the priorities of folks who want them to stop pumping more fossil fuels from the ground and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Top mining officials from Saudi Arabia recently announced that they are building out the systems and hardware necessary to extract the more than $2.5 trillion worth of metals they have so far located in their territory, for instance. And other state-run businesses have suggested they intend to do the same, leveraging their knowledge, their tools, their expertise to mine and process some of the resources that'll be most necessary, and thus valuable, for the transition to cleaner energy. Some U.S.-based big oil companies have made announcements about their own intentions in this regard, a few of them saying that they will pull lithium from their oil wells, while others claim that they are investing in rare earth mining infrastastructure. ExxonMobil recently announced that it would be returning to one of its old, long-closed oil wells in a small town in Arkansas to mine lithium there, which could be beneficial for their bottom line, but also for folks in that region who were left in the lurch when Exxon left to refocus on Texas in the 1990s. A coal company operating in Wyoming, with the help of the U.S. Department of Energy, recently discovered what could be one of the largest rare earth metal deposits in the world in Wyoming, and the biggest in the United States, on land that they originally bought for coal mining purposes. These sorts of investments are not consequence-free, as mining of any kind tends to deplete local resources, especially water and energy, and can have serious and deleterious effects on people and ecosystems, too. But this does seem like one of the more likely avenues via which these companies' interests may slowly come to align with those of folks and businesses and governments and organizations that are trying to segue the U.S. and other economies to clean energy. And that is meaningful because otherwise these companies almost always represent the most significant, well-moneyed and lobbyist-employing roadblocks to legislation and investment that would speed up the deployment of renewables and associated infrastructure. So this type of pivot would conceivably give them reason to support rather than hamstring those efforts. That said, some of these announced efforts may end up being mostly public relations plays, similar to how big oil companies have dangled the possibility of cleaning up their emissions using carbon drawdown technologies. And they've done this for years, but few such investments have been made, and most of the deployed tools toward this end to create clean coal and things like that were eventually retired, and they mostly didn't do what they were supposed to begin with. So there are potential avenues via which priorities might align more closely in the coming years, if the economics of such paths can be worked out and if the market validates them. But there's also a chance these opposing interests remain oppositional for the foreseeable future, even though both arguably scratch necessary itches and both represent anchors and wings for politicians who support and rely upon them. The book I'd like to recommend today is called Eversion by Alastair Reynolds. And this book is hard to describe. It is ostensibly science fiction, but a lot of it takes place in the past or in alternate histories. And it is bizarre and interesting and strange and fulfilling in the way Reynolds books tends to be. So I'm going to read some of the copy written by the book's publishers, because there's not much that I can say other than what they have said that wouldn't give away something important to your experience of the book if you decide to read it. So this is from the publishers of the book, quote, "From the master of the space opera comes a dark, mind-bending adventure spread across time and space, where Dr. Silas Coad is tasked with keeping his crew safe as they adventure across the galaxy in search of a mysterious artifact. In the 1800s, a sailing ship crashes off the coast of Norway. In the 1900s, a zeppelin explores an icy canyon in Antarctica. In the far future, a spaceship sets out for an alien artifact. Each excursion goes horribly wrong, and on every journey, Dr. Silas Coad is the physician, but only Silas seems to realize that these events keep repeating themselves. And it's up to him to figure out why, and how to stop it all from happening again." End quote. Now, if any of that sounds interesting to you, consider picking up a copy of Eversion by Alastair Reynolds. You can subscribe to receive email updates, find show notes, and other such content, and support this show financially, receiving additional bonus episodes as a thank you at letsknowthings.com. Learn more about me and my work at Colin.io. Subscribe to my other news-focused podcast, One Sentence News, wherever you get your pods, or at onesentencenews.com. And say howdy on social media. I'm at Colin is my name on Instagram and Twitter, and Colin Wright on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Colin Wright, and I'll talk to you again next week.